Today is July 20th, 1990. My name is Richard Dwelly, and I am interviewing for the Salisbury Oral History Project James H. Bates, who is a master at Salisbury School. And we're going to talk today about his impressions of Salisbury, its history, its philosophy, its people, where it's come from, and what it is today. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Dick.
What was your first contact with Salisbury and your impressions of that? How far back does that go?
It goes back to the winter of 1942 when my brother was a student at Salisbury, and my family saved up about 6 weeks of gas ration tickets in order to drive up from Redding Ridge, Connecticut. I remember driving over the Salisbury town line on the Housatonic River, and I saw the sign "Welcome Salisbury, Connecticut," which was even back then on the edge of the road. And my father said, "Don't get too anxious, Jim, because Salisbury is a big town and we're still about 15 miles from the school." And we were about 12, I think. We came up onto the campus. My recollection is that it was early December and it was rather bare. Obviously, there were no leaves on the trees. And the main building, we approached from the north side to the north dormitory wing at that time. And the campus was open on the north, with the main building oriented north-south. And the gymnasium, a stucco building, facing the, as you drove in. And then on the left of the walk, there was Payson Dormitory, which was had been built in 1929. Beyond that, there was a small mountain cottage that was used as a faculty house, and that was it. That was the entire campus.
Are those buildings there today?
Yes. The main building has been about two-thirds completely renovated, new wiring, new plumbing, with the building torn right down to the studs. It was found that it's a very sound building, and there's a new dining room on the southern portion. The whole front area and south dorm and kitchen have been totally rebuilt as of 1988. And so the building is completely modernized with the exception of the northern wing, which is the same as it was. The gymnasium was converted, which was built in 1911, was converted into a dormitory in the fall of 1959 with two faculty apartments and a room for 23 boys. And Janet and I and Jimbo and Judy moved into one of the faculty apartments in the fall of 1959. And I ran that dorm for the 4 years that we lived there prior to moving into a house. Payson Dormitory was the modern building on the campus. It was then about 14 years old. Very solid, sound, modern building with two faculty apartments on the southern side, which are still attractive apartments, and then a bachelor's pad kind of on the third floor, which has been converted into a regular apartment.
Let's go back, Jim, to when you went to school there.
Okay.
What were your early impressions as you drove to the school and three buildings?
Yeah, I remember the school was exactly the way I described it when I arrived in the fall of 1945 as a fourth former or 10th grader to go to school. The faculty, as I recall, had 11 men on it, 10 or 11, all male. Obviously, at the end of the war, the maintenance tended to be a little bit on the threadbare side for two reasons. Number one, the war had prevented the normal maintenance of buildings that we would expect today. And the second thing, the school had no money at all. It had been in desperate financial shape and had barely survived the war, really due to the strength of the personality of George Langdon, the headmaster, who came in 1942, and that's another whole section on him. I do remember, however, the strength of the faculty. a man named Mus Feruzky, who...
What was his first name?
Yeah, good question. Maurice. Maurice Feruzky, who owned and ran the Housatonic Bookshop, where John and Elise Harney live now. And that was a very, very famous rare book shop. And Mus was hired by George Langdon, I'm sure for no more than a dollar a year, to come up and teach history. He was a member of the class of 1916 at Yale, and a real scholar who had owned the same rare bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, before he moved to the northwest corner, something which I hadn't realized until fairly recently. The person teaching English was Harold Corbin, who now runs, he and Florey run the Three Ravens, and actually my fifth form or junior year, I lived down across the street in the big white house where Woody Rutter and the Beaners now live, and that was reopened as a dorm as the school began to grow at the end of the war. So my first year, as I recall, we had 96 students. The second year it went up to about 110 or 115 with that dorm opened across the street, which we called Lake Cottage. Now it's Kerr House. And then in my senior year, I think we gotten up to about 126 or 27 students. And by the June of 1948, the school was not only surviving, but was beginning to really prosper under George Langdon's leadership. So we had Harold Corbin and Mus Feruzky teaching an English history and English literature to fifth form, 11th grade, and American history, American literature to sixth form, the seniors. And I don't care what school you would have gone to, no one had a better English history and American history literature background than we had. And as I went on to Yale, why, it was almost a reprise of freshman of my senior year in my freshman year, when I actually took sophomore English and did extremely well because we had been so well grounded and had learned how to write.
Speak so well for the school.
Yeah, and I think that people like that, and I've talked about Harold and Mus, but Ed Tappert, who taught me Latin and German. Latin, I barely survived. I think my final grade in my sophomore year was 61. Hannibal and I had trouble in the Alps. But he was a wonderful teacher who gave himself to Salisbury and was there for, I think, from 1938 until he retired in 1974. And he died about 5 years ago. He lived at Noble Horizons, and we became good friends, and I actually had power of attorney for his daily expenses as he got more and more ill. He also taught 3 years of German to me and to two other boys, George Young, who went to Princeton, and Fred Jarvis, who went on with me to Yale. The three of us were in class learning German, and while we had just 3 years, we really became fluent. You don't escape from a strict master if there are three people in class. We did our homework. And Ed was a punster, a marvelous man. And I went on to Yale, took scientific German in my freshman year, which was a junior course, to get rid of the requirement. And then did nothing with German. Obviously, the Korean War, I was drafted. Went to Officer's Candidate School, and then went to Germany, and found out after 10 days in Bavaria that I really spoke fluent German, to the point where border guards and other German people would come up and say, Bist du ein Amerikaner, or Bist du ein Deutscher, and I would say, Nein, ich bin ein Amerikaner, and they would be surprised that I was an American, even though I was in a lieutenant's United States Army uniform. It was kind of fun to be that fluent. I was, in addition to execing a field artillery battery, I was our beer requisition officer. Illegal, but a very important position in a battery.
Jim,
I came back.
Okay, all right.
I came back, couldn't wait to go up to see Ed Tappert and speak to him in my fluent German, since I was practically a native German, from a German point of view. Came onto the campus, we started to talk, and Ed got visibly angry with me. And I asked him, Warum? Why? And he said, Du sprichst Süddeutsch. In other words, I was speaking Southern German. rather than the northern German, southern German being kind of Tennessee or Arkansas German, but I was stationed in Bavaria, so I picked up the bad accent. And Ed was, that's the kind of a person he was, though. He was a scholar, he was a perfectionist, and a marvelous, marvelous teacher. John Myers, Wim Kerr teaching math, Wim music playing the organ, Sam Carr, who came back to the school during my time there and worked for another 20 years, having retired. These people I can talk about as you triggered, but Ed Tappert, Mus Rusky, Harold Corbin, tremendously significant teachers in my background.
Okay. Obviously, that was the case as you went off to Yale, just mm-hmm. Several steps ahead of everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other impressions you had about the school when you were there, mm-hmm. and of the town, if you have any of those okay. Still hanging around?
Yeah, to take the last first, the town, George Langdon always felt that Salisbury School was part of the town of Salisbury. I think partially because he was able to hire local people who would come up and teach, and as I said before, he paid them damn little. But they were clearly upstanding citizens in the town. And so he would always tell the boys, all of us, that when we go downtown, the people in Salisbury are our neighbors and our friends. And they are not to be treated lightly or treated as servants, as some adolescent boys tend to do sometimes. And I think that carries over. I know at school meetings I speak to the students about living downtown, being a taxpayer and involved in the community, and often community people will become part of our chapel talks, which I give 5 or 6 times a year, and other faculty members do, so that we have tried to engender in the school student body a sensitivity and a respect for the people in the town of Salisbury and the school's relationship to it. In addition to that, in recent years, we've had a lot of people on our faculty who've been involved in the town of Salisbury. Carl Williams just retired as chairman of the Finance Committee. Mark Henning and Finance Committee of the town of Salisbury. Mark Henning is, Jackie Rice is our CPR, the members of the ambulance squad, and very active in that. Mike Dalton, until he went to Tennessee, was a member of that. I've been involved in Sharon Hospital. So there's a large group of us that are involved in community affairs, and I've just hit 2 or 3. Bob Gardner was a member of the school board, and so on and so forth. So I think both at the student level and at the faculty level, we try to have an involvement in and respect for the town, and that's, I think, been a positive relationship we've had with the community. Likewise, we also provide more dollars in scholarship aid to local students than does Hotchkiss. That's not relative dollars, that's real dollars. We have always had a commitment to educating local boys and allowing them to come to Salisbury regardless of ability to pay. And I think there are people, Joe Reel came from Camp Canaan, his dad was a postmaster or postman over there, and Joe now writes for a paper in New York. So he had an article a couple of years ago about this relationship of school and town.
Expanding on that relationship, if it's appropriate here, I don't mean to cut you off by any means, but we discussed before we began recording the school's philosophy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the town is part of that philosophy. Is this an appropriate time to expand on that a little bit, do you think?
Yeah. Okay, philosophy. Salisbury, and I think this would go back to the founder, the Reverend George Quayle, from what I have read about him, and then to Emerson, his son, and certainly to George Langdon, who was my headmaster and who married Janet and me and who I worked for when I came back as a faculty member for 6 years. George believed that there were no bad boys, but he also realized that good boys do bad things. And using that as a benchmark, it really starts those of us who work with kids at a point where you try to correct the bad things and make good boys do good things. That sounds simplistic, but it really isn't. The school has tried to teach well and to teach the basic subjects, i.e. math, languages, history, literature, well, but also it believes very strongly, I think, and has over the life of the school, that the liberal arts without a moral foundation is worthless. And so you, if you're educated but don't have a philosophical underpinning for that education, you can become a Boesky or someone like that. Therefore, I feel strongly and always have felt that the, and say it at school meetings, that the most important building on Salisbury's campus is the chapel. Not to make Episcopalians out of everybody, that's the last thing we would want to do, but to allow the school to come together in a different setting and in a special setting to be able to talk about ideas and about right and wrong, and through the Judeo-Christian tradition, and I say not Christian tradition, but the Judeo-Christian tradition, to go back to the Ten Commandments and to see the relationship of what we do every day in math and in music and in literature and in history, to see the relationship that that has to the moral underpinnings of Western civilization. And to me, it's very clear. If you take the Ten Commandments, and then Christ, then St. Augustine, and then Bede, and from Bede you move into the development of the early universities in Western Europe, and out of that comes the Western tradition, and you have to wind up at democracy, and there's no other place to go. Having given 2,000 years of Christian thought in 1 minute, I'll stop. But I think that relationship, education with a religious or ethical tradition, is a connection that has to be made. You can't have good education without a foundation and really basic principles, and ours is this Judeo-Christian tradition that the school is a part of. And it expresses it through the Episcopal Church, but we have rabbis and Muslims and all kinds of people and lay people come and talk in the chapel, including people like Ambassador Shoffley and Harrison Salisbury, so that the guys get a broad view of different ideas and not just arithmetic and English and history.
While we're on the subject of philosophy and what it's done for the boys that have attended the school over the years, can you tell us the names of some of the better known students that may be out in the world today or have been out in the world that have made their mark and expressing the virtues of that you've just described?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and this is one of the things I have. I think that Salisbury boys, the downside of this might be that they tend to go into service areas perhaps more than leadership areas. The names are going to be hard to come by, but the next head of McGraw-Hill will be a Salisbury graduate. We have had people in government at the Secretary of the Air Force level. We've had executive vice presidents of major oil companies, in fact, one of whom resigned, and I went to solicit him for a $50,000 gift for our new gym that we built in 1983, and he said, "Jim, I'll either give you $5,000 or $50,000, and if I give you $50,000, you'll know I've moved to Pittsburgh. If I give you $5,000, you'll know I've moved to Atlanta and retired, and that will because I will have to compromise my principles, and if I do, it's Salisbury's fault." And that guy happened to be a couple of years ahead of me, and he did choose to retire. So it's hard to say. I don't think in terms of famous people, G. Menon Williams was a Salisbury graduate, but there are not, I don't think, people we would call famous.
Okay. I meant famous in carrying on the basic traditions that they...
Yeah, my guess is that would be a lot of the graduates who carry stuff on. And in my travels when I was fundraising, I was always impressed when I would I would often ask a question, as you think back about your life at school, what seems to be the most important thing, or what do you think of first? And I was dumbfounded at how many people said the chapel, which we then did every day. And I think that that really says what I was saying earlier, that that connection is at least subliminally made, and these guys begin to think about the hills and the country, and of course the chapel's oriented toward the hills, so that that all becomes a part of their personal warp and woof and philosophy.
Maybe a logical outgrowth of what we've been discussing so far, what you've been discussing so far with me, would be the founding of the school. Mm-hmm. You touched on that a little bit. Do you have anything to add to that, do you think?
Yeah.
What year was that?
School was founded in 1901. And the story goes the Reverend George Quayle had a school, St. Andrew's, on Staten Island. And he felt that parents were interfering too much. And apparently he had a brother-in-law. There was a relationship who summered up here. So they came to visit Salisbury, and they bought the farm on Frink Hill in 1900 and built the school. Mrs. Quayle was a lady of substance, I think would be a nice way to put the late 19th century term. And so the main building was built, and it's interesting, we spent $2.7 million on it a couple of summers ago, and it's only two-thirds redone, where the first insurance coverage on the main building was for $25,000. I happened to find that in some of the papers that I was looking through several years ago, and it is shocking. So they built the school. It was owned by the Quayle family until 1924, when it incorporated as a nonprofit institution. And the rector, the Reverend George Quayle, and Mrs. Quayle continued as headmaster and lady leader and setter of a lot of tone, I think, until her death in 1930 and his in 1935. Again, as you look through the early Sarum books, the school magazines printed in the early 1900s, which I have read all of, you get that sense of we're going to make these boys behave, we're going to make good people out of them, in addition to good students. And that effort to work with a boy, not just as an intellectual person, but as a thoughtful, committed human being. I think that relationship is there from the early years all the way through the history of the school.
Would this be an appropriate point to ask you, why not girls?
Okay.
I'm sure that the school has concerned themselves with this question.
I was a trustee from 1974 till I came back to work at school in 1980. And in 1976, I actually chaired the first trustee student faculty committee on coeducation. We split philosophically. We had two votes at that time. Split philosophically about 50-50 as to whether to coeducate or not. And in terms of doing it at Salisbury, then we voted 16-0 against doing it, because we realized that to coeducate is a lot more complex than simply putting girls in rooms and carrying on your school. It's a whole process. I said to a foundation head this last spring that I think coeducation in many ways would be good, but I'm not concerned about sex. I'm concerned about size. If we coeducated and carried on our relationships with the schools that we've been related to for a long, long time, Westminster, Millbrook, Pomfret, schools like that, and then some bigger schools, which we row against, Choate, we play Hotchkiss in some sports. If we had the base of 250 boys to provide a strong athletic program, which I think is very important to this whole building of an individual, why, we'd have to have 150 girls, and school would have to go to 400, and that would totally alter the school. I think all of us on the faculty, at least the vast majority of faculty members, by Christmas time, we know the name of every boy in school, and we probably know half of them reasonably well. And I know in last year's graduating class, there wasn't a student I hadn't taught. I think that relationship of individual to individual is terribly important at the adolescent age.
Back to the original philosophy.
Yeah, right, to know the whole person. And if we got bigger, it doesn't mean we'd be worse, but we'd be different. And I don't think any of us who've been associated with the school for a long time really want to lose the ability to get to know some young men very, very well. And if we add young women to the mix, why, yeah, the young woman or the young man will see just as many faculty members, but they won't see the same faculty member in different areas. And that's what makes our kind of education, I think, very special, and which allows it to serve a lot of kids very well.
I guess the next thing that you said you would like to touch on, and if you can expand more on the people, can you do that?
Yeah. I think you've got to start, George Quayle, Emerson Quayle, I never knew, if we took the headmasters and then kind of went through. George Langdon served the school from 1942 till 1964 when he retired. He was a big man, a very shy man in many ways, but a very strong man. He had a view of what the school should be. He took over a school that was in desperate shape in June of 1942 with numbers of students in the whole war process. He had a philosophy that you never spend money you don't have. And so when the school did anything, it paid cash for it. And it came out of the tradition of the 30s where there simply was no money at all. So he carefully husbanded what we had. As I said, or alluded to before, he was a master at hiring people. And he got the right mix of people and brought them together and then allowed them to do their own jobs. And I think, again, that's still a philosophy where those of us on the faculty feel very free to work within the range of our own ideas, but the choice has been made in the hiring process. So that you get a broad mix of people and then let them do what they do well. George Langdon really built the school. He brought it from moribund to, in 1950, building Memorial Hall, a major classroom building. In 1954, built Quayle House, a faculty house and dormitory for 16 boys, which has been doubled in size, two faculty houses and now 34 or 5 boys as of 3 years ago. In 1958, the John C. Myers Gymnasium was built, and in 59, the old gym became the dormitory and faculty housing that, as I said, Janet and I moved into. So that new gym added really two buildings to the campus. And the last building was really built by the trustees in 1960 and 61, and that was the new chapel, which meant a tremendous amount to George Langdon, and he loved that building, and it was really the capstone of his career. And instead of having the chapel in the basement of the main building, which was a very attractive smaller chapel but did not lend itself to weddings and outside events, this chapel is a building I think that we all think a great deal of. During his career, the school grew from, as I said, I think about 67 or 68 boys his first year, it went through the 150 to 160 mark. And of course, once we got to 150, and I was on the faculty as a young man then, well, I was never going to go above 150, and then went to, I think, about 157. It was never going to go over 160, and then it went to about 165, or never going to go over 175. Well, it's now 240. And my guess is that we have been at 240 for a long time, and I think that unless a move toward coeducation comes, we will stay in that, right about where we are now. The plant seems well balanced for that, with a few exceptions, library addition and so on and so forth. So George Langdon put the school on this incredibly sound base physically, and also carried on through the excellent hiring of people to keep a core faculty. The Reverend Edwin M. Ward and his wife Aileen came in 1965, and Ed and Al also committed themselves to Salisbury School. It became their school, or they became a central part of it immediately. And Ed served the school through the difficult late 60s and early 70s and up until 1981, when he felt he should leave because he'd been there at that time 16 years, and he told me, I was then president of the Board of Trustees, and we talked about this, that if he stayed until he retired, he would have had 28 years at Salisbury, and he felt that that was just too long to have the school under one head in the period we had been through. He was an excellent teacher, carried on with the academic tradition, bringing in a different kind of faculty than who were far more individual in their orientations as we kind of moved into the post-Victorian era. But he brought on a faculty that, while diverse, still had that commitment to kids. And Ed was more conservative, I think, religiously than George Langdon was. And it's interesting that we tended to become more of a church school and more oriented in the Christian way or Episcopal way than we had been under George Langdon. I never heard George Langdon say church school that I can recall. Ed Ward used that word a lot. Woody Rutter, who became the director of admissions, taught French and is now our development director, and has been there 20-some years himself. When Ed retired, why, the catalog was changed the day after Ed and Al left the campus to take out a school founded in the Christian tradition, and it became a school founded in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and the people who made that change were Woody Rutter and Jim Bates. We did it the day Ed left, or the day after, because we both believed strongly in a broader tradition, but Ed wasn't, but he was very conservative in that way. Wonderful man, great sense of humor, had a wonderful way of writing and getting his message about what the school stood for into publications. And he spoke at alumni gatherings. You knew through the turbulent 60s and 70s, you knew that here was a man who said what he believed and believed it deeply. And I think that with all the strains and stresses and the beginning of the drug age and the Vietnam War and all these crises that occurred during his tenure as headmaster, Salisbury bent but never broke. And other schools had a lot of problems, but we were able to handle them. And I became a trustee during this period and developed a tremendous respect for Ed and for Ted Childs, the associate headmaster, in the way that handled these kids in a not easy era. We are more back now. We're back to where it's much easier to talk to students and chit-chat back and forth, and they don't seem to have the antipathy toward institutions, which was a part of the early 70s, where the institution was necessarily bad. We grew up when something was wrong, it was you, not the institution. They went flip the other way, where everything's wrong with the institution, and I'm fine. Well, now we've reached a better era. But Ed really built the school. The endowment when he left was still under $1 million. But after the chapel came, the science building was built in 1978. Well, if I go back and go chronologically, in 1959, the library was built. 1967, Langdon Dormitory was built, which houses about 26 boys and two faculty. 1970 or 71, Carr House was built, another large dorm. 1972, Beelan Lodge, a student union, was built. And then we got what other buildings during the 70s? 78, the science building was built. And then that was the last building built during Ed's tenure. I think that as we got the science building, which is a fine building with individual biochem and physics laboratories and space photography and then some other ancillary spaces, that building really did a great deal for the faculty and for parents as they came around the school. With Memorial Hall, it gave us two classroom buildings, which are together fairly impressive, especially the new science building, which is very well maintained and very easy to maintain. And it says something academically. In 1983, we built a new gym, a new gymnasium, the Childs Gym, which was is next to the Myers Gym built in 59, and that becomes a fine athletic complex. So I think that in the academic buildings, parents and students see this is a place committed to strong academics, and in the gymnasium and the fields, gymnasiums and the fields, they see that this is a place that pays attention to the physical aspects of development. So Ed and Al, you have to almost mention their names together, Ed and Al Ward, as you mentioned George and Ann Langdon. Ann Langdon, who I've skipped, was, and who now lives at Noble Horizons, was a very, very potent force for social graces, for right and wrong, and was very much a partner of George Langdon's, as Al was for Ed. Those two headmasters, I think, were very, very important. In 1982, why the Reverend Peter Sipple and Margaret became the leaders of the school. Peter is headmaster, and Margaret, who taught English, his wife. Margaret was, again, an excellent partner and a part of the school. Peter stayed 6 years until 82 to 88. And since this is a history and history should be the truth, I don't think that Peter ever really committed himself to Salisbury School. He obviously a minister, had a PhD in, I think, religious thought, and a very bright man who loved music, and music was his real strength. But I frankly don't feel that he made that commitment that our other headmasters had to the school. He saw it more as a job. In spite of that, during his time, the Harvey Childs Gymnasium was built, a major addition to the athletic plant, and the addition of doubling the size of Quail House with Quail North, a faculty home, and an addition of about doubling the size of that dormitory was done. And in addition to that, the Mountain Cottage was renovated in 1983, and that was a faculty home and small dorm, and that became a health center. So we have a very good health center. In addition to that, the endowment in 1980 was $945,000, and in June of 1984 it was $3,034,000, with having done the infirmary and the gym, and since I was assistant headmaster for development during that period, I'm very proud of it. Peter and I were friends or acquaintances, but not really good friends, and I would hate to prejudice this history, but I think that other people would agree that he came to Salisbury never having taught in a boarding school. He had been the headmaster of a school in Portland, Oregon, Oregon Episcopal Academy. So he didn't realize that this is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, that those of us who work at a boarding school, it is our life for 9 months of the year. And he intellectually understood that commitment. He was a Choate graduate, but he didn't understand it in the gut. And if you don't understand it in the gut, you're not going to become a schoolman. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. And I think, plus the fact that he had been heavily involved in music in Oregon, and we're a little bit far from a music center. He's now headmaster of the Moravian Academy in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and there is a city chorale and stuff that he's involved in there. So I think that very important musical side of his life was left somewhat vacant during his time here. In 1988, Dick and Sally Flood arrived, Dick being the first headmaster who was not an Episcopal minister, other than the son of the founder, and who was Emerson Quayle. And of course, that choice may not have been quite so open, because the Quayle family had the mortgage on the school in 1935. But Sally and Dick arrive, and Dick, again, he's finished his second year at school. He is a consummate schoolman, and that is an expression that I use very sparingly. I'd say maybe 5% of teachers deserve the title good schoolman. Dick certainly does. He and Sally came from Noble and Greeno. They are a partnership. He is a wonderful schoolman, has that sense about boys, knows where they're at, again, committed to the whole boy, really enjoys as a non-minister, he and having come from a school without the kind of philosophical underpinnings that the chapel has provided us, he's very happy to have that and very comfortable with it, and feels that it does strengthen the school tremendously.
I'd like to ask this question. Mm-hmm. Is there an official tie with the Episcopal Church, or just in philosophy?
If the school closes, the property goes to the Episcopal Church. We have no financial connection with them at all. The chapel is, I think, described as a mission in the town of Salisbury. Therefore, at least in theory, it becomes a part of St. John's, but it really isn't. And we're independent. As a mission, you can do things that might be less accepted in the Episcopal Church. We've had some interesting services at Salisbury. For instance, memorial services where the Episcopal pattern has not been used, where there have been eulogies, where there's been music. When Hop Rudd died, why the band played The Saints Go Marching In, and that's perfectly appropriate at Salisbury School and for Hop Rudd, which would not, I don't think that the Reverend Bevan would cotton to that particularly.
You mentioned Hop Rudd. You haven't mentioned him as a person before this.
Yeah.
You care to comment on him and perhaps others at this point?
Yeah, there are.
Have you finished? You
well, no, I guess we've gotten through the headmasters.
Did you give Mr. Flood his due?
Well, I think he's finished 2 years, so we're busy beginning to raise money to pay down the debt, which we had to incur in the renovation of the main building, because the state said we have, obviously the new 1980 fire laws in the state of Connecticut had tremendous impact on that building, as it has on many buildings in the state of Connecticut, and so that we're involved in that project. I think that the thing to say about Dick is that we all hope that he stays a long, long time, and that philosophically he fits very well. He's very hardworking and is committed to Salisbury School, and that ain't all bad. And a very, very fine schoolman. Just that relationship, the way he handles students and the faculty, but he is a part of this, very much of the school. We have very good leaders in both Dick and Sally. That kind of does the headmasters. As we go to other faculty, and obviously Hop Rudd would be one of those. There, we've got Carr, Myers, I mentioned Kerr, Gardner, Corbin.
What about some first names?
Rudd, okay. John C. Myers, Edwin Tappert.
How do you spell that?
E-D-W-I-N. Tappert, T-A-P-P-E-R-T. Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, Kerr, K-E-U-R, is retired, lives just beyond the Catholic Church on the way to Hotchkiss School now. And Wim taught me Algebra 2. He came about the time Ed Tappert did, and they retired the same year. Bob Gardner, who retired last year. Harold Corbin, I've mentioned. Hop Rudd, I haven't mentioned, but certainly will.
His first name was
Roswell H, R-O-S-W-E-L-L, H. Rudd. The H stands for not Hop, but I think the nickname came from that. And, Hop was a piece of work.
Good musician.
Yeah. Those, should I start through those?
The tape is about to end.
Okay.
Why don't I turn it over now?